This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio. Our originally scheduled program on the anniversary of the U.S. Constitution has been rescheduled for Friday, September 21st. So today, this hour, we visit a conversation Ben Kiefer had with author Scott Kowalty, who tells us about the infamous Mark family killings and reflects on the mind of a mass murderer. On Halloween night in 1975, Jerry Mark murdered his brother's entire family, four people, including two young children, in Cedar Falls. Since 1976, Jerry Mark has been held at the Iowa State Penitentiary in Fort Madison, where he is serving four consecutive life sentences. Kowalty's book, Brother's Blood, takes readers inside the murders that sent shockwaves through the community of Cedar Falls and the state. Author Scott Kowalty on the Mark family murders, right after this hour's news.
This is Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we learn about one of the most cold-blooded mass murders in Iowa history. On Halloween night in 1975 in Cedar Falls, Jerry Mark murdered his brother's entire family, four people, including two young children. This hour, author Scott Kowalty will tell us about the infamous Mark family murders and reflect on Jerry Mark's motivations. Kowalty's new book, Brother's Blood, takes readers inside the mass murder that sent shockwaves through the community of Cedar Falls and the state. Since 1976, Jerry Mark has been held at the Iowa State Penitentiary in Fort Madison, where he is serving four consecutive life sentences. When I spoke with Scott Kowalty, I began by asking him to describe the scene found on the morning of November 1, 1975, on the Mark farm outside Cedar Falls, and who first came upon the murder scene.
He was a farmer that worked with a Mark. Clark Renner was his name. And he came early in the morning, 6:30 or 7, to get up and help with the drying operation. They had a corn drying operation. They were in the middle of the fall harvest in 75. And Clark came as usual. He had tried to call the Mark family earlier on his phone from the truck. He was an advanced farmer. He had a phone in his truck. And there was no answer, and he found that surprising. So he went to the house and knocked on the door, banged on the door, yelled outside, and was extremely surprised to find no activity. And when he tried to turn on the corn dryer, it didn't come on. So there was no electricity and nobody in the house, or at least nobody stirring. And then he was really surprised and downright alarmed. So he did not go in the house. He looked in and he could see that the back door, the porch door window, was broken out. And a plant was strewn across the kitchen floor, a fern plant. And again, that shocked him. He thought somebody must have broken in, and the family either was gone or had not responded. So he went down the road about 2 miles to the Mark, the elder Marks, Dorothy and Wayne Mark.
This is the parents.
This is the parents, and they were living 2 miles away. That was their home place for years and years and years, and then Leslie and Georgine had recently moved in September. So he went there and he said, Dorothy and Wayne, something's going on at the Mark, at your son's house. Let's go see. And of course, they were as alarmed as he was. And they were, although Dorothy said she did not suspect a crime. Nobody suspected it a crime. She thought maybe they had stayed in town with their friends. So they just went there somewhat casually thinking, well, what's going on? And Dorothy and Clark, Wayne was very sick at the time with cancer. He stayed in the truck and waited, and Dorothy and Clark walked in and walked over to the door, the bedroom door, which was downstairs off the kitchen, and there was blood seeping out from under the door. And she really, of course, struggled to know what happened and tried to push the door open and could not get the door open. And she pushed and pushed and shoved and finally squeezed it open enough to see both Georgine and Les lying on the floor face down with pillows, on pillows, their heads are on pillows, with multiple gunshot wounds. And at that point, she knew something was completely, utterly, terribly wrong, and nobody had ever seen anything like this. Two people killed, and she immediately just thought, well, now what shall we do next? And Clark kind of took a little control, although they were both in shock. And they both immediately thought about the children. And so they went upstairs. Children had separate bedrooms, very large house. And they found Julie in her bed, also shot in her face.
5 years old.
5 years old and chest. And went in and found Jeff. Little Jeffrey was 1.5. And he was shot. They were executed, basically, two small children in their beds on Halloween night. And at that point, of course, they just started. There was a bit of hysterics, but they stayed in control like Iowa farmers are wont to do. Mm-hmm. But they immediately called the sheriff, and the crime scene was sealed off, and they began investigating.
So we have law enforcement showing up, the then Bureau of Criminal Investigation.
Yes, the BCI.
The BCI showing up. Tell us about the clues that they found initially that proved to be important here and what their initial actions and thoughts were.
Well, they first thought it was a murder-suicide. It was just inconceivable that somebody would execute this family in their house for no particular reason. There was clearly no robbery. I mean, they could see things had been strewn around to make it look like a robbery, but it was so amateurish they didn't take it seriously. So immediately they tried to find a gun. They assumed that Leslie had a gun and that he had shot his kids and then come down and shot his wife and then shot himself. But when they rolled the bodies over, there was no gun. And that was Jack Hobelson's point. No gun, he said. The sheriff said no gun meant that it was a murder. They had a quadruple homicide on their hands in a rural farmhouse, reminiscent, of course, of In Cold Blood, the Clutter family in Kansas, which was a few years before. So they immediately went into action and began thinking, all right, now what's going on here? And the first thing they noticed, which Ruxlow mentioned several times, Tom Ruxlow, the lead investigator for the BCI, the grandfather clock in the hallway had been smashed, really beat up. And it was an heirloom clock that Leslie and Georgine bought for themselves as kind of a family heirloom. And they knew that this was a kind of family deal because who would bother to smash the grandfather clock? I mean, that's what they began thinking. And Ruxlow put it like this. He said it looked like someone tried to cut off a limb of the family tree, the children, the father, the mother, and then this kind of anger toward an heirloom. They began thinking family. And in fact, Ruxlow said, whenever there's multiple murders, you always look at the family first. Mm-hmm. So they started thinking about where are the brothers? And there was a brother in Waterloo, Tom, and there was a brother in Canada, the oldest brother, Dick, and of course, Leslie, the youngest, and then Jerry. Where's Jerry? And that's when they began asking questions about Jerry, and they immediately called California. He was living in Berkeley. And his girlfriend said that he was not there. He was on a motorcycle, and she thought he was riding in Southern California, finding himself, as she put it. He was kind of an itinerant worker, although very highly educated and highly intelligent. He was not working at the time. So he had bought a motorcycle, and he was riding around camping for several days and just looking for what he should be doing with the rest of his life.
Back up a little bit and tell us a little bit more about Jerry Mark, who is still alive. He's serving out four life sentences in Fort Madison, the state penitentiary.
Yes.
Back up in Jerry Mark's life, growing up in Cedar Falls, he was an outstanding student. Vice president of the senior class, graduated in 1960.
Mm-hmm. Jerry and I were classmates. Jerry Mark and I went to school together, and I knew him. I didn't know him intimately. We didn't hang around together. The farm kids and the city kids didn't do a lot together, at least I didn't. But Jerry was in the choir and the theater, and I think he was in some athletics. And so we sort of knew each other. I knew certainly of him. He was a year ahead of me. He graduated in 60, and I graduated in 61. So we had been in musical things and talked, and I enjoyed him. He was a very smart guy. He was liked, well-liked, respected. He was a 4-H leader. He eventually joined the Peace Corps and went to Brazil as a Peace Corps worker, and he went to law school. He graduated from University of Iowa Law School, got a law degree, passed the bar, and did some social work, for legal work in Des Moines for poor people. So he was known as kind of a, not exactly a missionary, but he had a spiritual bent and believed that poor people needed help, and he thought legally was the way to help them. So he was a lawyer who paid attention to the social causes, and the very, very last person anybody would have thought could have done this.
The investigators, led by Tom Ruxlow, the Bureau of Criminal Investigation, were going and looking at the family. They saw indications that someone in the family had something to do with this murder. What then first aroused suspicion that it might be the older brother, Jerry Mark?
Nobody could find Jerry. Nobody knew where he was. He hadn't called in. He had called Mimi, Marilyn Forrest, Mimi, his girlfriend at the time, eventually his wife. And he'd called her Thursday night from Nevada, he said. from Lovelock, Nevada. In fact, he was in Cheyenne, and he had plenty of time to get from Cheyenne to Iowa on Thursday to Friday night if he rode hard and fast. But he didn't call on Friday. He didn't do anything on Friday. No contact at all, which was very suspicious. And he didn't call Saturday, which was also suspicious. He didn't actually call till Sunday. And so there was 3 days of silence from Jerry, and he was on his motorcycle, and they knew he was somewhere out west. They didn't really think he was anywhere near Iowa, but as it turned out, he was riding like mad from Berkeley to Iowa on his Honda 450. And he made it to Iowa, killed those people, got back on his motorcycle and rode. He got all the way to Wyoming before he took a hitch to ride with a trucker.
He was arrested only 9 days after the murder. And this is stands out as a remarkable achievement in investigation in Iowa law enforcement history, doesn't it?
Well, you know what? These guys took this personally. They all had children. These were young prosecutors, and there were three lawyers and almost immediately involved. Dutton as the lead lawyer, lead prosecutor, county attorney who became the special prosecutor for this case, and Ruxlow. All these guys knew of the Mark family. Tom Ruxlow had lived in Cedar Falls, and they also loved and had Ben Moran children and had children themselves. So they saw this as really a slaughter of innocents, not to mention the parents being innocent. So really, they took it very seriously. They worked day and night, 24 hours a day, traveling all over the western states, trying to figure out what he might have done, where Jerry might have been, and they began looking for eyewitnesses. And they turned up many eyewitnesses fairly early that he was not where he said he was. And then the key break right toward the end, just before they arrested him, they made their way to Ken's Sporting Goods Store in Paso Robles, California, not far down the road from Berkeley. It's where his wife at the time, they weren't divorced yet, lived with his daughters. And he had gotten his hair cut down in where she lived, I can't think of that, San Luis Obispo, that's right. And then he had driven up the highway to Paso Robles and stopped at Ken's Sporting Goods Store and bought a box of .38 Long Colt cartridges. This very odd cartridge, nobody had seen or heard much about these cartridges at all. You could not fire them in a regular .38 pistol. And it turned out, as Mimi said, they had a pistol that he had found. They had kept, and it fired 38 Long Colt cartridges, this extremely odd caliber cartridge or kind of cartridge. So he bought them, and not only did he buy them, he signed Jerry Mark, and he gave them his Social Security number. I mean, he was immediately identifiable as a purchaser of these bullets. So they called the policeman, the detective in South Lake Tahoe, where Mimi's parents were living. And they said, you must interview Jerry Mark. He was coming back, and by then he had been in touch with Mimi and the parents. And he was coming back from Iowa, actually. And they interviewed him Monday morning. The murder was for a Saturday morning. Monday morning they interviewed him, and they asked all about the gun, where he got it, what it was all about. And he began stuttering and stammering. I have the transcript of the interview. And it was clear, I think it was clear to the detective who interviewed him, that something was going on. And he relayed that to the police in Waterloo, who decided they really had to interview him at great length on Friday of that week. The funeral was on Tuesday. They kept him around town, interviewed him, and decided the evidence was mounting that he was not where he said he was, that he had bought these pistols, and that had enough evidence to arrest him. And they did on that Monday, the following Monday after the Friday interview.
This 38 Long Colt, an unusual weapon, I'd like to ask you, Scott, to read a little bit out of your book now, because this book, and we want to talk about it later, is done in the style of a Truman Capote In Cold Blood, where you are taking the evidence, transcripts and letters and so forth, the actual facts of the case, and then creating a story along with some fictionalized parts. Read, if you would, the piece where Jerry, the fictionalized account of where Jerry finds this .38 Colt.
Right. Something like this had to happen. I know that from the sources, from the interviews with Mimi and from the transcripts, he found this pistol and a bunch of junk in a trailer, camper, they stole from Olga. Mimi's husband was Olga at the time. She was not yet divorced either. And they stole it from outside his trailer where he was living and drove it to her place so they could rummage through everything and get materials for her. And this is the passage where he finds the pistol that he knew was in the trailer. He just didn't know what it looked like and what it was about. So this is the passage. Jerry turned to leave when he saw an old leather holster with a revolver half hanging out. It looked huge, and when he pulled it out, he noticed the imprint on the barrel, 38 Long Colt. It's in pretty good shape, he thought, certainly in working condition. Olga probably saved it for camping trips. Bears and cougars roam the California mountains, and shooting this gun would more than scare them away. It would surely kill any human intruders, Jerry thought. He hefted it again, suddenly noticing that Olga had left it loaded. That startled him. Loaded weapons meant trouble. His father had let his four sons handle and shoot shotguns, but never handguns or rifles. Even a .22 rifle slug could carry a mile, his dad reminded him many times, and might wound someone's livestock, shatter a window, even kill a neighbor. Though Jerry had grown up with shotguns, he had little experience with handguns. He opened the cylinder cover and shook out four bullets. He slid the empty weapon back in its holster and wrapped it in a Safeway sack so it looked innocuous. Good thing the barrel was imprinted with the right size ammo, otherwise it probably wouldn't shoot, he thought. Out of all that junk, here was one item that might have value. He decided to just put it away out of reach of his daughters and Mimi and see what he could get for it. It probably would come in handy someday, for cash, if nothing else.
Scott Coelty reading from his new book, Brother's Blood, A Heartland, Cain and Abel. It's a new book in which Scott Coelty tells the story, the riveting story, the horrifying story of Jerry Mark, who was convicted of the slaying of his brother's wife, and their two young children on a farm outside of Cedar Falls on Halloween night, actually November 1st, 1975. It's published by Ice Cube Press. Tell us about the atmosphere in Cedar Falls. This made huge headlines statewide, but it was such a shock to Cedar Falls. I'm a native of Cedar Falls. Mm-hmm. I was a preteen. I was a boy at the time. I remember it clearly. Mm-hmm. But you were an adult at that time. Tell us about the shock to the community and Iowa at large.
Well, we couldn't stop talking about it. It was just nothing like anybody had ever heard. I was actually eating downtown on Saturday night. It happened that Saturday morning. And there was just a wave of interest, and friends I was with said, did you hear? And I said, you don't mean Jerry? And they said, no, Leslie. I didn't really know Leslie. He was considerably younger. I knew of him, and I certainly knew the Mark family, but I knew Jerry, and I felt sorry for him. I said, oh, my God, Jerry's just going to be devastated. And Jerry was, in fact, best man at Les's wedding. They were close friends, at least reputedly. So it was a terrible shock, and the sense of fear and struggle and confusion and frustration that this could happen in our town, which was kind of an Eden on the prairie, you know, the Lawn City. And the funeral was planned for Tuesday. They had 1,000 people show up. Jerry was just beside himself. There was a well-covered, I don't think there were television cameras in those days, but it was certainly well-covered by newspapers. And the obituaries were given. The town was riveted by the news of the deaths and then the funeral. And then the family all being together, there was people gathered around them, including George and Margaret Colthurst, stayed with the Marks during the funeral and after. And the guilty person who had done it was actually among them. That's another shocking aspect of this story, is how Jerry just sort of fit right back into the family routines that whole week. And then after he was arrested, of course, everything changed. But there was a week of gathering and feeling very sorry and grieving and wondering and worrying. Everybody was worried that this was somebody who was crazy, who could come back and kill more.
A killer on the loose.
Yes, exactly. And people armed themselves, locked their doors. This was a community under siege, in a way. There was worry that there would be more killings.
So there's this horrifying mass killing. Jerry Mark is arrested for it. And how much time passes between the arrest and the actual trial in which Jerry Mark is out on bail, walking around Cedar Falls, preparing his case?
Well, this is sort of a shock. He was around walking in Cedar Falls, working, living with his parents for 5 months. I mean, through all of December, through May. The trial started in May and went through June. Part of June actually lasted about a month in Sioux City. So he wasn't actually tried until May of 1976 and then convicted in June.
Mm-hmm. So set up the defense case succinctly against the prosecution. We have this really high-profile attorney, Lawrence Scalise. against the prosecution. We have the prosecuting attorney, David Dutton, mm-hmm. Tom Ruxlow, the BCI investigator. Mm-hmm. Put the two cases, juxtapose them, and tell us what you see.
Well, in 1980, I had been very curious about this case because I knew the family and I knew Jerry. So I wrote him when he was in Fort Madison. And I said, Jerry, I'd really want to talk to you because I know you've said you're innocent. In fact, he claimed that he was going to kill himself. He was going to jump over the prison wall and run, and they were going to have to shoot him because they'd imprisoned an innocent man. And I thought, this is getting so far out that I just have to talk to him. I can't quite believe he would write something like that. It was in the papers. So I went to, he said, come on out and talk to me. I hope you can help me. And he remembered me from high school. So I drove to Fort Madison with Linda Kettner. She was helping me with the interviews. She was a record reporter that reported on it. And I talked to him. I said, Jerry, I just don't understand how this could have happened. He said, well, the legal system is so screwed up. There are so many people anxious to convict an innocent man or convict someone for this murder because it scared people so much. They just leapt at me, and here I am in prison suffering because they can't find the right guy. And he went on and on about what he had done. And my big question, because I had read the trial transcripts, is why he didn't explain his story from the stand. He didn't have a good story that explained exactly what happened. He had piecemeal fragments of stories. Basically, his defense was that he rode in toward Nebraska. He found a young hitchhiker. I think he called her Ginger, but that name changed from time to time. And had her on the motorcycle and was frightened that Mimi would find out he was with a woman on the motorcycle, enjoying himself no end. But he didn't want to explain that to anybody because he felt so ashamed of it. So he kept his identity, or rather he kept his location a secret, told Mimi he was near one city when he was really near another, way closer to Iowa.
And phone records bore this
right.
out.
And as he got closer to Iowa, he just stopped calling. Because at that point, he didn't want to tell her anything about where he was, and he said he was going to be finding himself, so why should he have to call her all the time? Mm-hmm. So the evidence just mounted, and I said, Jerry, it's just so strange to me that you didn't take the stand and try to explain it. And he said, well, I asked my lawyer, Lawrence Scalise, I asked Larry to let me take the stand, but he wouldn't let me. Well, Larry said that Dutton would have a field day with me, and I wouldn't be able to answer the questions. I'd look silly. I said, I cannot believe your lawyer wouldn't let you testify on your own defense. And he said, well, that's what happened. So
you talked to David Dutton.
I talked to Lawrence Scalise the next day. I said, Lawrence Scalise, sorry. Right. I went to Des Moines and I said, Mr. Scalise, I don't understand why you didn't let Jerry take the stand. And he said, is that what he told you? I said, yeah, it sure was. He said, well, I told Jerry Mark that if he didn't take the stand, he was going to be convicted. Because there's no way that anybody's going to believe him without a coherent story of where he was. And he wouldn't do it. He was afraid of what Dutton would do. And in fact, David Dutton, bless his heart, gave me the cross-examination notes. And I used those in a dream. Jerry got scared in the book. And he dreams of what Dutton would do to him. And in fact, that dream is based on Dutton's actual notes from what he would have done to him. Mm-hmm. And it would have been a slaughter. I mean, he just had no clear story. It was just fabrication after fabrication.
Coming up after a short break, author Scott Coelty will tell us more about the Mark family murder case when our conversation continues here on Iowa Public Radio. And we're back on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we're learning about one of the most cold-blooded mass murders in Iowa history from author Scott Coelty. On Halloween night in 1975 in Cedar Falls, Jerry Mark murdered his brother's entire family, four people, including two young children. Coelty's new book, Brother's Blood, takes readers inside the murder. Now back to my conversation with Scott. The jury reached a guilty verdict in only 5 hours based on a huge body of circumstantial evidence. I asked Scott to take us through the murder with the mindset of Jerry Mark as he believed it to be. From the time Jerry Mark left California on his Honda 450 to cross half the continent to kill his brother's family. A warning, some listeners may find parts of the conversation disturbing.
Well, it had to be a terrible trip. My hypothesis, he's not talking about this part of it. My hypothesis is that he took a lot of caffeine pills, no-dose pills. I don't think he took any speed. I think he was too worried about the effects. He had to be very wide awake for what he was about to do. So he took some pretty serious caffeine pills. He did sleep off and on for a few hours here and there. He slept in the truck on the way back. He was picked up by a trucker, and the motorcycle was put in the back. Horse hauler, hot truck, was put in the back for several hundred miles from Cheyenne over to Utah, Salt Lake City, I think it was. And so he was able to sleep, but basically he did not think that the Iowa prosecutors and investigators were smart enough to catch him. He was extremely arrogant, absolutely convinced of his own abilities to elude the law. He had carefully planned this from the very beginning, and knew exactly what he was doing. He planned to absolutely ride that motorcycle and then ride back with nobody seeing him, nobody detecting him, and then certainly nobody actually coming after him all the way out there and finding those bullets, the cartridges that he bought. He just was convinced that he could do it.
Jerry Mark, after several days traveling on this small motorcycle to the family farm outside of Cedar Falls, tell us what you think happened when Jerry came upon the house, how the killings were carried out.
Well, the first thing he did is he hid in the ditch, and he cut the wires to the house, the phone wires, not knowing that those phone wires no longer connected to the house. They had been changed fairly recently. So he really made his first mistake was to cut the wires, not knowing that they weren't the right phone wires. So Dorothy immediately called out the next morning, no trouble. And the neighbors lost their phone service. And I think it was Ruxlow, immediately knew, well, somebody thought those wires connected to the house, but they were misinformed. Who would think that? And, of course, Jerry hadn't been there in a long time, and he thought those were the phone wires. And then he made another awful mistake. He slipped in the ditch and lost two of those 38 long Colt cartridges out of his jacket pocket right into the ditch. And the next morning, a deputy walking the ditch found them. They found two live cartridges that matched the same caliber and eventually the same lead lots as those that were found in the bodies. So those were the cartridges that killed them, and they were 38 long Colts. And the lead lots from those cartridges matched the lead in the bodies. And that was testified at the trial, although that was neutron activation analysis, which is eventually was disallowed because it gave some false positives. But anyway, the way that he actually did it, he snuck into the house, hid downstairs, probably smoked a couple of cigarettes. He got kind of nervous downstairs.
There were cigarette butts found as well.
Right, yes, and Marlboros, and they had the typo. I mean, there's some issue with that in terms of the evidence that was brought up in the appeals, because the DNA evidence on the cigarette butts gave false positives too. But anyway, he stayed downstairs, and then he snuck upstairs, and the evidence seems to show that he turned on the light so they could see him and they recognized him.
This is his brother, Les,
yeah.
And Georgine,
right.
His brother's wife. He has entered the bedroom, mm-hmm.
Right.
and startled them out of sleep.
Yes. He had startled them immediately, and of course they woke up with the light on, and he shot down between them. There was a cartridge found in the floor that did not hurt anything. It just probably startled them and scared them. And then he began ordering them around. And then, well, it gets very graphic here. This is a hard chapter to write. But he shot Les five times and Georgine four times. He pumped nine slugs into his brother and his sister-in-law and made them kneel down on the floor and sort of executed them from behind. Two shots went into Georgine, the very same place in her head. And then, it's almost too horrible to contemplate the scene in that bedroom, the chaos and the noise. Mm-hmm. And then the two kids were upstairs, and the evidence seems to show that Julie heard a lot of commotion.
This is the 5-year-old girl, the older girl.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
The daughter and his niece, Julie, stood at the top of the stairs with a pillow. She pulled the pillow off the bed and said, who knows what she said? I have a fictionalized account there. Who's shooting firecrackers? And then recognized him. But I actually, in the chapter, I don't identify him. He's just the intruder because he keeps disguising his identity. I paid attention to that, and his identity is not clear from that chapter. And then he takes her back to her bed, seems to have smoked another cigarette in her bedroom because there was a cigarette butt found under her bed that did not match anything the deputies had left. There's a crime scene issue there, I know. And then he shot her twice, head and heart, and then walked into Jeff's. Evidently, Jeff didn't wake up, shot him in the head and heart, same place.
The 21-month-old boy.
Yes, with this 38 caliber, very large caliber pistol for shooting at point-blank range. And then ran downstairs, smashed the clock on the way out, through the window. This was on the way out. make it look like a robbery, pulled some drawers out, and then walked down to his motorcycle, which was hidden in the ditch. And he wore some tennis shoes, and the prints were found and seemed to match his gait that were found in the yard outside, and then climbed on the motorcycle and took off.
Back to California.
Yeah, and this was about I think the clock stopped at 3:03, so it was between 3 and 4 in the morning, probably leaving the house by 3:30.
How is it possible for you as a writer, for anyone to get into the mind of someone capable of doing this to anyone, let alone a close family members?
Well, imagination is a wonderful thing, and I talked to him enough, and I immersed myself in the trial transcripts, all the police interviews, the newspaper stories, and I knew him. Having talked to him at length, I interviewed George and Margaret Coldhurst, the parents of the slain woman, Georgine, and at great length I talked to Dorothy. She was happy to talk about it. I think it was sort of cathartic for her to talk to us about it, and also she was concerned that we tell the whole story because she absolutely thought Jerry was innocent, and the more that was known about him and the family and the loving family they grew up in, the more people would be convinced he could not have done it. So I have 30 single-space pages of interview transcripts from her, and the same with George and Margaret Coldhurst, who were convinced on the other side that he was a snake. George said he had black eyes that looked bottomless. They looked just like a snake's eyes. He's not happy with this whole scenario, of course. He's not happy is way an understatement. He's furious about it and thinks the death penalty should have taken care of Jerry right after he was convicted, because he was such a monster and did this monstrous thing to their family.
Mm-hmm. So. Tell us about the years since that guilty verdict in 1976 of Jerry Mark. In this killing, there were appeals?
Many appeals. I think there were 4, maybe 5 total. They were basically the same. There was some problem with the DNA evidence on the cigarettes and some other issues with some of the eyewitnesses that weren't exactly reliable. But nothing that held much water. His appeals kept getting turned down until 2006. Now, in 2006, the story had gone cold for me. I was sort of not concerned about it. I thought it was just more or less a dead issue. But the Judge O'Brien in the 8th District Court of Appeals said that Jerry should be set free or got a new trial, one of the two. The trial was not fair because there was some exonerating evidence that had not been admitted that Dutton had, this was O'Brien's case, that Dutton had not given to the defense. And then basically Jerry should be let go. This was front page news, and I was flabbergasted. I was amazed. I could not believe that all this other evidence was ignored in this appeal. So at that point, I made a decision. I have to tell the story. I have to let all the other evidence be told, because this man seems to have convinced at least one judge that he's innocent. So I began writing the book seriously then, and I wrote a paper about the rhetoric of the trial, and I delivered that paper at the Cedar Falls Library, and 300 people showed up. We had to give it 2 different nights because there's so much concern. There's so much curiosity about this case in this city, actually in the whole state, I think, still, because people remember it as this trauma. And so there was encouragement from the amount of interest, and then I kept thinking, what's going to happen with this appeal? So the state of Iowa, and it took 1 year to do this, the state of Iowa took that case before a 3-judge panel who turned it down and said there's absolutely no way he should get another trial. The evidence was overwhelming, and a new trial would not change anything, even though there are some inconsistencies with some of the evidence. The overwhelming preponderance of evidence, which would be presented again, would show that he's guilty.
Mm-hmm. In your book, Brother's Blood, Scott, you write toward the end of the book about the 3 aspects of this case that stand out for you most. I'd like you to talk about those. We've touched on them, the mind of the sociopath, the aftermath, and then finally the meaning of it all. Talk about those things that really stand out for you with this intimate knowledge of the case.
Well, I realize that we don't really know what life is all about most of the time. We don't know what people are thinking. Jerry was putting on a good front. He was absolutely furious, totally overcome with anger at his brother, for basically, as he told Olga when they were still friends, screwing him out of his farm. he thought he deserved to run the farm, to manage the farm, to manage the business, and that his brother had screwed him out of it. And then his father had engineered this kind of relationship which kept his brother and he kind of fighting each other over several issues. And there's a famous quote that everybody used and, in fact, mentioned in the trial several times. When he came back in May at this family meeting, he told his father, "Old man, when you die, I'm going to come back to Iowa and piss on your grave." And there was that sense that there was this burning, white-hot anger toward Leslie. And when Leslie moved into the place, the home place, and took over the family operations as CEO, the youngest brother, he just couldn't stand it anymore. He thought something had to be done. And there was some very crooked land dealings as well. So what was going on in Jerry's mind was just not knowable. Nobody knew what he was thinking. He was planning this multiple murder. He bought a motorcycle with a wind fairing. He bought a cold weather riding suit. He bought the cartridges. I mean, he planned and planned and planned. And on the surface, he was still Jerry Mark, just being kind of the itinerant handyman out in California with the woman he was living with, who was basically supporting him, and made a life for himself out there as a kind of future serial killer. And I always wonder how much we know people that are normal, in fact, normal in every way, except they're doing some horrible things in their minds, and that if they take action, they become these strange, monstrous creatures that we can't really predict or know about. And I mentioned in the book that at the time I was finishing the book, I was teaching Alfred Hitchcock, and Hitchcock was a filmmaker that covered this. I mean, he really realized that normal people, everyday people, are subject to very strange whims that lead them into some very dark places. And that's what Jerry became. He went to a very dark place. I think he had sociopathic tendencies all his life, but he became a full-blown killer because of the pressures of his family and his own sense that he needed more out of life that he wasn't getting because of his father and his brother.
Scott Coelty is the author of Brother's Blood, which recounts the story of Jerry Mark, who is convicted of slaying his brother's family outside of Cedar Falls in 1975. What has become of that farmhouse? Is it, am I getting this right, on Union Road?
Yes, it's actually about 4 miles from where I live. I go by it a lot. It's a very nice place. It's been remodeled. I've been out there several times. They sang in a madrigal group that met there and rehearsed, actually. It was a B&B for a while, and now a family owns it, and it just looks like a wonderful house. The only thing that looks similar is the roof line. And the roof line is the same roof line that's on the cover of the book that was taken from the crime scene photo by Gary Kelly, a wonderful artist that did the cover. So you can recognize the roof line, but the actual look of the house has changed completely.
Not any owners in the Mark family, though.
No.
And that land, what is left of the Mark family?
Well, the family went bankrupt. The family fortune was probably completely dissipated, partly by the trial that's cost them so much to help Jerry out. And Dick Mark was not a financial manager. The older brother was more of a spiritual manager. He worked as a minister for several years. And he came back to run the family businesses and made a lot of bad decisions. And eventually the family just went broke, and they just didn't have any money. They sold a lot of land to pay bills, and then the whole place was just dissipated, and all of the land has been sold off, and there is no such thing as a Mark family farm operations now.
Mm-hmm. In writing this book, I assume you took your inspiration in the writing style, the approach to the book from Truman Capote and In Cold Blood. Describe the type of fictionalized treatment of this true story that you worked through, the rules that guided you in weaving together the facts of the matter that you had with fiction necessary to create a continuous narrative.
Well, this was a challenge. I originally wrote it as a novel, a four-part novel, one whole part from Jerry's point of view, and I set him up as a fictional character telling his story as a character, 90 pages of here's what happened to me, and I've been screwed by being put in prison as an innocent man, and I'm so furious about it, and what am I going to do? And he was basically dying of cancer. This was the fictional part. And explaining that he'd been in jail all these years because of a prosecutor that didn't know what he was doing, but it convicted him wrongly. And so the fiction part I liked because I could really use my imagination and create a story based on the Jerry Mark story. and then tell the real story as a refutation to his story. And I thought that kind of worked. But it didn't really work. I mean, the fact was everybody kept saying, okay, where's Jerry Mark in this, and what's this have to do with, et cetera, et cetera. And Dan Dundon, actually the Courier reporter who reported on the trial, had already written a fictionalized account, Lassiter Hill, that I read several years ago. And he did that, and it's not necessary to do another fictionalized account. So I began thinking, what I really need to do is write an account of the real thing with all the sources there for everybody to see. In fact, 100 and some pages of the book are nothing but sources that I used to write the story. So I created a character based on Jerry Mark that's extremely close to the real Jerry Mark. I was not there to get his dreams. I've never interviewed him about what he was dreaming, but I have his dreams, his thoughts, his conversations, but they tie directly and exactly into the facts of the case.
Were there any legal problems using real characters in this semi-fictional account?
Yeah, I think whenever you use real people and call them characters, you've got an issue. And I talked to a lawyer at some length, and he suggested a disclaimer. And the disclaimer that's in the book twice should really take care of that. It explains that I made a lot of stuff up, and I put it in the sources section is the real thing, and the stuff that I made up, which you can differentiate if you read the sources section, compare it to what I actually wrote, which you can do chapter by chapter. You can see what I made up.
What has been the reaction so far to your book in the greater Cedar Falls community and in the state?
There's been a tremendous amount of interest. People are still curious about it. They still remember that the Judge O'Brien said he should go free, and they remember where they were and what they were thinking and saying and talking about when it happened. I mean, they're people my age, of course. So people have come and bought 5 and 6 copies at a time and asked me to sign them. I'm getting requests from all over to send them copies or tell them where they can buy it. I'm speaking at service clubs and, actually all over the place. And people are buying the book quite a lot around here. My curiosity and my publisher's curiosity is whether anyone out of Iowa, outside of Iowa or Blackhawk County even, will be interested.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a book that will draw people in, whether they know the case or not, is our question.
Mm-hmm. And also my question then would be, you know, is this book the end of the Mark family murder story for you? Would it be told in another medium?
Well, you know, Scott Smith is a videographer downtown, and he got interested in the case, heard me speak on it a couple, 3 years ago. And he and I, mostly him, to be honest, but he and I sort of together wrote a screenplay. It's called Shadows in the Dark. It's actually a wonderful screenplay, and I hope it gets made into a film. It sort of uses the DNA of this story, the same kind of character and the same action, the motorcycle trip and the killing of the brother. But it's really a story about two policemen struggling with the evidence as it emerges and kind of the initiation story of a younger policeman becoming a real policeman through the guidance of an older policeman.
Mm-hmm.
So it isn't really this story, but it's enough of the story so that it would carry a lot of interest.
Do you have any—you have such an intimate knowledge of this case going back so many decades,
mm-hmm.
Scott Kowalty. Do you have any remaining questions, the biggest questions about this case, something you think is still unanswered you'd like to find out?
Well, I guess my big question, which I probably never will find out, is what Jerry thinks. I mean, does he actually know what he did? At this point, the mind of this man is a mystery to me. I don't know whether he believes he did it and he was rightly charged and he's serving time because he deserves it on some level, or whether now he's convinced that he didn't do it, he's believed his own story. I mean, I know strange things happen with human psychology, and I think there's a good chance he believes his own story, even though all the evidence shows that he did it.
Jerry Mark has been in prison, serving 4 life sentences since 1976,
mm-hmm.
Now at the state penitentiary in Fort Madison. That would make him about how old?
He would be 69.
And do you know anything else about his current state after being in prison for decades?
Well, you know, I think that he is well-known and well-liked in prison. He's a polite guy. He's very smart. He knows law. I think that he's helped prisoners with their appeals. I mean, I think he's probably a personable guy who gets along with everybody, although I don't know that for sure.
Any thought to going back and asking for another conversation with him?
No.
Why not?
Well, I just don't think there's anything to say. I mean, if he still believes he's innocent and that I've betrayed him by writing this book, then we have nothing to talk about. Now, if he's willing to talk about it and say, all right, I did it and you got me and the evidence does show it, of course, then I'd be more than willing to talk. But from all the evidence I've heard, He's absolutely sure that he didn't do it, and he was wrongly convicted, and he will stay with that story to the end of his life.
Scott Cowalty, I want to thank you so much for this conversation. A fascinating read, a fascinating case, a horrifying case in Iowa history that you brought to life in Brother's Blood. Thank you very much, Scott.
Thank you, Ben. I appreciate your interest.
Scott Cowalty is the author of Brother's Blood. Host Ben Kiefer spoke with Cowalty last September. This River to River program was produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer, production assistance from Emily Woodbury, technical support from Dennis Reese. In Cedar Falls, help from Phil Moss and Tony Daner. The executive producer for Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Thanks for joining us.